Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we bring you a lecture by Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. Professor Sen is Boston University's first visiting professor at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. During this academic year, Professor Sen is delivering a series of lectures on the future of identity, which explores questions that arise from the way people define themselves in terms of group membership. Professor Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998 for his contributions to welfare economics in the areas of social choice, welfare distributions, and poverty. Tonight's lecture is entitled The Idea of Identity. Here now is Professor Amartya Sen.
Many of the contemporary political and social issues revolve around the conflicting claims of disparate identities. Since the idea of belonging and the conception of identity tend to have far-reaching effects on our thinking about ourselves and about others, a sense of identity can be a source of pride and of comfort, but it can also be the basis of irritation, hostility, and even violence. It can also be a source of anxiety. In an arresting passage in A Turn in the South, V.S. Naipaul expresses a worry about losing one's past and one's historical identity in the melting pot of the present. I quote from Naipaul. In 1961, when I was traveling in the Caribbean for my first travel book, I remember my shock, my feeling of taint and spiritual annihilation when I saw some of the Indians of Martinique and began to understand that they have been swamped by Martinique, that I had no means of sharing the world view of these people whose history at some stage had been like mine, but who now, racially in other ways, had become something other. Unquote. Concerns of this kind bring out not only an apprehension and a disquiet, but also the positive and constructive importance that people tend to attach, as clearly Naipaul does, to a shared history and a sense of a possible community based on this history. And yet, history and background are not the only way of seeing ourselves and the groups to which we belong. Also, if background and history are important, this is not independent of how we decide to see these classifications. There are a great variety of categories, and this is a central point I want to get across first, great variety of categories to which we simultaneously belong without any contradiction at all. I can be, at the same time, an Asian, an Indian citizen, a U.S. resident, a British academic, a Bengali with Bangladeshi ancestry, a graduate of two colleges in two different countries, an atheist with a Hindu background, a non-Brahmin, an economist, a researcher and teacher in philosophy, a Sanskritist, a married man, a feminist, a defender of gay rights, a non-believer in afterlife and also before life, a non-believer also in frequent visits by extraterrestrial aliens in austere spaceships, but a believer in the view that if such aliens do exist, they ought to make their spaceships a lot jollier and more colorful. This is just a small sample of diverse categories of people to each of which I may simultaneously belong. There are, of course, a great many other membership categories which I could mention. My belonging to each one of these groups can be, depending on the context, quite important. But when they compete for attention and priority, I have to determine what relative importance to attach to them, again, depending on the context, to each of these memberships. There are two distinct issues here. First, the recognition that identities are robustly plural and that the importance of one identity need not obliterate the importance of others. Second, a person has to make choices, explicitly or by implication, about what relative importance to attach to the divergent loyalties which may compete for precedence. In contrast with this way of seeing things, it is sometimes argued that identity is not a matter of choice at all. The quote-unquote constitutive conception of community, as Michael Sandel, my friend at Harvard, describes it, has received much championing in communitarian thinking. And in this view, I quote from Sandel, community describes not just what they have as fellow citizens, but also what they are, not a relationship they choose as involuntary association, but an attachment they discover, not merely an attribute, but a constituent of their identity, unquote. The communitarian identity is, in this view, preeminently peerless. But why so? Communitarian thinkers are, of course, right to point out that presuming uniformity of all people and ignoring our specific affiliations to the communities to which we belong may entail a very big loss in our lives and understanding. Where we have to go much further than that is in recognizing that we are not only diverse, but diverse in many different ways. We have to decide what priority to give to the various identities that we may simultaneously have. A person's choice may be constrained by the recognition that she is, say, from a Muslim or a Christian background, or even that she is a religious Sunni or a practicing Catholic. But there is still a decision to be made by her regarding what importance to give to that particular identity over others that she may also have, related, for example, to her political belief, her sense of nationality, her racial background, her sense of gender or feminist commitment, her professional attachments, the ties of language and literature, and so on. An exercise of explicit or implicit choice is inescapably involved in deciding on the priorities over the different aspects of our plural identity. When a choice exists, to deny its existence is not only an epistemic failure, to which I've been referring, but going now beyond that, but it also entails an ethical dereliction, since it allows a denial of responsibility that one has and that comes inescapably with the existence of choice. These choices can, of course, be very hard to make. That's not in doubt. Derek Walcott's poem, A Far Cry from Africa, nicely illustrates how wrenching a decision this may be. Situated in the Caribbean, Walcott notes the divergent pulls of his historical African background, including his sense of association from where his ancestors came to the Caribbean, on the one hand, and his loyalty, on the other, to the English language and the literary culture that goes with it, despite his reservations about the imperial rule that gave English such a pride of place far from the shores of Albion. I quote from Walcott, "Where shall I turn, divided to the vein? I who have cursed the drunken officer of the British rule, how choose between this Africa and the English tongue I love? Betray them both, or give back what they give. How can I face such slaughter and be cool? How can I turn from Africa and live?" This is not just an act of discovery in conformity with the constitutive conception of community. There is no canonical resolution of the choice of priorities or weights based simply on observation without assessment. Derek Walcott cannot simply discover what is his true identity. He has to decide what he should do and what room he should give, respectively, to the different loyalties in his life. If Walcott wonders what conflict there is between his inseparable attachment to Africa and his love of the English language and his effective use of that language, indeed his astonishingly beautiful and constructive use of that language, if I may add, the question of weights and priorities is one that he has to face. Classifications can take, of course, many different forms. And it's worth emphasizing that not all categories that can be consistently generated can be a plausible basis for a significant identity. Consider the set of people in the world who were born between 9 and 10 in the morning, local time. This is a distinct group, but it is hard to think that many people would get excited about solidarity of such a group and the identity it can potentially produce. Similarly, people who wear size 8 shoes are typically not linked with each other with a strong sense of identity on that ground. Classification is cheap. Identity is not. However, whether a particular classification can plausibly generate a sense of identity or not must depend on social circumstances. And even in these examples, it's worth remembering that. For example, if size 8 shoes became very, very difficult to obtain for some complicated technological or business reason, can't think what it might be, but let's imagine there are some, then the need for shoes of that size may indeed become a shared predicament and can give reason for solidarity in demanding a change and identity in acting together in harmony. I could imagine people chatting with each other where the last size 8 shoe had been spotted, giving each other a hint. Similarly, if some authoritarian ruler decides to curb the freedom of people born in the particular hour between 9 and 10 in the morning, perhaps because of the ruler's supernatural belief on the perfidy of people born then, or because of some Macbethian witches who have told him that he will be killed by someone born between 9 and 10 a.m., then again a case for solidarity and for identity may then well emerge for the hapless targets of the persecution that might result. Which identities matter is itself influenced by their relevance in the social setting, and we have to ask whether they are important and why. Before I leave this basic and elementary subject, I should also consider another methodological issue that often crops up in one form or another, both in culturally separatist discourses, including in some of the rhetoric of religious separatism and fundamentalism, and also in communitarian defense of the discovery, quote-unquote, view, and its denial of the existence of serious choice. Questions about choice are sometimes dismissed, not because of any imagined absence of these questions, but on the ground that our cognitive limitations prevent us from addressing them in an intelligent way, in an intelligently comparative way. It has been argued that a person situated in a community and a culture may not have access to other conceptions of identity and to other ways of thinking about affiliation. Their social background, firmly based on their own community and own culture, determines, in this view, the feasible patterns of reasoning about identity, ethics, and rationality. In some of the more fervent versions of what we may call communitarian distancing, we are told that we cannot invoke any criteria of rational behavior other than those that obtain in the community to which we happen to belong. Any reference to rationality in general yields the rhetorical retort, which rationality, or even whose rationality? This approach, which has had the effect of rejecting intercultural normative judgments and sometimes even of denying the possibility of cross-cultural exchange and understanding, has tended to draw inspiration from some schools of anthropology, not necessarily with strong parental approval. One result of this claim is to see the people of the world as being split up, as it were, into residents of little islands who are not within intellectual or normative reach of each other. Community and culture can, of course, have a strong influence on our thinking. That's not in doubt. But it can hardly annihilate our ability, given the opportunity, to think differently. The human mind can be imprisoned away from encountering certain types of thought, as many authoritarian guardians of society have indeed tried to do, but we cannot be reduced to total incomprehension, as we find out when these barriers are breached, as authoritarian guardians have themselves tended to find out whenever their disabling grip has been overcome. Indeed, if there were such incomprehensibility across cultures, what would be the need for the policing of adherence and of loyalty, which is so typically so active in isolationist regimes, varying from book banning in incarceration to the more trivial things of monitoring of headscarves or beards by fundamentalist authorities? Examples of official prohibition can be found in nearly every country in which the state tries to dictate a substantive position on how people are supposed to conduct their lives. What would be the necessity of this if ideas from elsewhere were really impenetrable? Incarceration and preventive exclusion are in fact the tributes that authoritarian guardians of community and culture pay to the intellect and imagination of its dissenting citizens. Cultural separatists are, of course, right to point out that one cannot reason from nowhere, a point that is often repeated. But the alternative to the discovery view is not choice from positions unencumbered with any identity, as some cultural polemicists seem to presume, but choices that continue to exist even in any encumbered position one happens to occupy. Choice does not require taking a leap from nowhere into somewhere, but being able to consider the possibility of moving from somewhere to somewhere else. The thoroughly fragmented view that has received championing from some communitarian thinkers is deeply problematic, I would argue, in its methodological grounding. There is a similarity here with the critique that Homi Bhabha makes in The Location of Culture of some versions of postmodernism. I quote from Bhabha: if the interest in postmodernism is limited to a celebration of the fragmentation of the grand narrative of post-Enlightenment rationalism, then for all its intellectual excitement, it remains a profoundly parochial enterprise. I'd now like to move from the first-person perspective to the third-person perspective on identity. We not only have to face the issue of self-identification, but also the fact that others too identify in one way or another. And very often, we may have rather limited choice in changing how others perceive. We can decide what importance we attach to that identity, but it may not be easy for us to make others think of us differently. Sometimes the way others identify one may change quite suddenly. For example, I personally have just discovered that I clearly belong to a category which I didn't know earlier, belong to the category of people whose physical appearance is such that they're separated out for very forceful scrutiny before being allowed to board on an aeroplane in this country or in Britain. This identity, which has revealed itself through a sequence of rather time-consuming and not entirely exhilarating experiences, may not have a functioning role at other times, but it clearly has suddenly become quite important. And this, even without my having the benefit of an Arabic name, unlike my son Kabir, to whom my late wife and I gave a Muslim name, it seemed like an appropriate thing to do for the son of a Hindu father and a Jewish mother. And this must place him in a further category of some practical relevance right now. Indeed, sometimes we may not even be aware how others identify us, which may differ radically from self-perception. In a lecture that I gave last year, I had the privilege, it was a British Academy annual lecture which I had the privilege of giving, I tried to illustrate the difference between first and third person perspective by invoking an old Italian story, and I cannot resist the temptation of invoking it here again because it's particularly relevant for the present discussion about the difficulty of influencing how other people think of us, the third first party perspective. It's a different point, but it also makes the point. The story which was current in Italy in the 1920s, concerns a political recruiter from the fascist party trying to persuade a rural socialist that he should leave the socialist party and join the fascist party instead. The rural socialist says, "How can I join the fascist party? My father was a socialist, my grandfather was a socialist, I cannot really join the fascist party." The fascist recruiter, of course, is exasperated by this argument, by this silly argument. He says, "What kind of an argument is this? What would you have done if your father had been a murderer and your grandfather had also been a murderer? What would you have done then?" "Ah, then," says the rural socialist, "then, of course, I would have joined the fascist party." It may not only be hard to change what others think of us, it is often difficult even to guess how others tend to see us. We cannot ignore the difference between the identity problem in the first and third person perspective, that's for sure. And yet, this does not at all imply that as a general rule we can impose identities on others, even very narrow ones, without taking note of the richness of their respective first-person perspectives. In particular, if we try to ignore altogether the plurality of identities of other people to which they themselves attach importance, we are bound to produce a hopelessly mutilated view of these people. Which takes me to the clash of civilization. Many of the difficulties and problems generated by the approach of the thesis, or the approach of the thesis of clash of civilization, which is receiving so much attention today, arise from imposing a very particular form of partitioning on the people of the world, a categorization that is taken to be so preeminent that they are evidently expected to override, this categorization is expected to override other ways of classifying humanity. Indeed, the primary problem with the perspective of clash of civilization does not lie in the unargued presumption that there must be such clashes, which is a subsequent and a further issue, also deeply problematic, but it's a subsequent issue. But the main problem lies, the immediate problem lies, in the partitioning of people of the world, allegedly in a uniquely profound way, partitioning into distinct civilizations, whether or not they clash. Same problem, whether even if you talk about amity of civilizations. This simplistic and impoverished categorization produces a misleading understanding of the people across the world and the diverse relations between them. And it also has the effect of magnifying a particular type of distinction to the exclusion of other important ones. I shall return presently to the perspective of the clash of civilization, but I must first address the methodological question that may well be asked as to why should classification, usually taken to be a fairly innocuous operation, rather lowbrow operation, often dismissed as taxonomy, should be taken to be so important. It may well be asked, actually not entirely without reason, whether my thinking has been undermined by my own specific cultural background. It's of course well known that Indian epistemology is replete with the belief that classification is the source of all knowledge. 6 systems of philosophy, 12 types of emperors, 16 types of rhetoric, 24 types of warriors, and 64 different positions for making love. There may well be something of an Indian obsession here, but I would like to insist, prejudiced or not, that classification is indeed critically important in a great variety of epistemological problems, with ethical relevance, and this is one of them. Indeed, as Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, has argued, a socially accepted classification can even create categories that would not, but for the social identification, have much substance. As Bourdieu points out, a socially devised categorization can end up, I quote, producing a difference when none existed. And social magic can transform people by telling them that they are different. I quote from Bourdieu again. That is what competitive examinations do. This is an example he's giving. The 300th candidate is still something. The 301st is nothing. In other words, the social world constitutes differences by the mere fact of designing them. Even when a categorization is arbitrary or capricious, once it's articulated in use as the basis of an empowered dividing line, the highlighted groups acquire derivative relevance and can even be extremely influential. Such can be the power of a new but forceful classification that once it's given primacy and uniqueness, there is often a tendency even to reinterpret the past. Goes against the principle enunciated by Agathon that even God could not change the past. When people are suddenly informed that they're not really what they took themselves to be, they are often persuaded to invent past hostilities or divisions that might not have actually existed, or at least not been significant or powerful. The new hatred between, say, the Serbs and the Albanians can then begin to look like an extension of an allegedly pre-existing, quote-unquote, past hatred, age-old hatred. In the contemporary world, there are many terrible examples of very modern atrocities based on newly inflamed detestation that are then dressed up in retrospect as continuations of alleged age-old hostilities and battles. Any kiddie in school can love like a fool, Ogden Nash had claimed, but hating my boy is an art. That art is widely practiced by skilled artists and instigators, and the preferred weapon of choice often is a reclassification of groups and identities. For example, the dramatic amplification of the alleged gravity of the dividing line between the Hutus and the Tutsis, quote-unquote, we Hutus have always hated the Tutsis, with the eschewal of other classificatory principles related, say, to class or occupation or location or language, which cut right across the division between the Hutus and the Tutsis, can convert one of many coexisting dividing lines into an explosive and confrontational division with incendiary power. I'm reading at the moment, just finishing, my friend Shahryar Khan's book called The Shallow Graves of Rwanda. He's a Pakistan diplomat who also was the UN commissioner in Rwanda. It's not a book I recommend for evening, nighttime reading. It just is a harrowing account. But it also brings out clearly how so many of the hostilities were devised and generated by instilling a sense of division which had not exactly existed in that form. I return now to the thesis of a clash of civilizations, and in particular to the imposition of specific identities that this entails. This is an important issue to consider, particularly at this moment, since the terrible events of 11th September have had the effect of making the confrontational diagnosis of a clash of civilization look much more plausible. And yet the clash thesis, with its neglect of actual history in favor of stylized accounts, its ignorance of interconnections, its disregard of deep diversities within merged categories, and its static understanding of classifications and barriers, can scarcely be right. The important question is not whether it is wrong, but why it is wrong. I would argue that the idea of a preeminent classification that is uniquely relevant is an epistemological as well as ethical and political mistake. A basic problem arises from the unargued presumption that to classify the people of the world into civilization is not only a valid procedure, I shall argue presently that it's not, but that it is also uniquely informative about people's identities, allegedly relevant in a way that no other classification can be. The search for the unique classificatory principle is not, of course, new in the world. To some extent, even the classification of people into workers and non-workers, workers or capitalists, for example, over all other forms of categorization, had that simple feature, which had a profound influence in restricting the way left-wing activism had tended to proceed. That this claim to unique relevance was misleading, even for those with a commitment to the underdogs of society, is now widely acknowledged. And it is perhaps worth recollecting in this context that Karl Marx himself subjected disputative uniqueness to severe criticism in his Critique of Goethe Program, 1875, written a quarter century after the Communist Manifesto, his almost the last writing. And it's very relevant to the present debate, though in a different context. So I quote from Marx, "Unequal individuals, and they would not be different individuals if they were not unequal, are measurable only by an equal standard insofar as they are brought under an equal point of view, are taken from one definite side only. For instance, in the present case, are regarded only as workers, and nothing more in seen in them other than their being workers, everything else being ignored." Unquote. There is similarly much grossness in seeing individuals only as a Muslim or a Hindu or a Christian, nothing more being seen in them. Not also in terms of their class, wealth or poverty or community or profession or politics or commitment or interest. Even in terms of religion, the classifications are far too aggregative. For example, in describing India as a Hindu civilization, Samuel Huntington's exposition of the alleged clash of civilization has to downplay the fact that India has many more Muslims, about 125 million, more than the entire British and French populations put together, than any other country in the world, with the exception of Indonesia and marginally Pakistan. Also, it is futile to try to have an understanding of the nature and range of Indian art, literature, music, food, or politics without seeing the extensive interactions across barriers of religious communities. This includes, of course, the Hindus and the Muslims, but also the part played by Buddhists, who were, of course, extremely dominant at one stage, Jains, Sikhs, Parsis, Christians, who have been in India since at least the 4th century, well before there was a single Christian in Britain, Jews, present in India since the fall of Jerusalem, and even atheist and agnostic, with a remarkable record of survival against all odds and much opposition right from the 6th century to today. Indeed, Madhvacharya's 14th century authoritative Sanskrit classic, Sarvadarshan Sangraha, collection of all philosophies, devotes its first chapter entirely to the views of this school as one of the preeminent traditions of Indian thinking. Huntington's categorization of India as just a Hindu civilization may delight the modern tribe of Hindu fundamentalists, but it's a peculiarly narrow reading of India. Civilizational partitioning suffers, in fact, from two quite distinct problems. First, the civilizations are hard to partition in this way, given the diversities within each society, as well as the historical linkages between different countries and cultures. Second, there's very little substance in the implicit presumption underlying the reliance on civilizational classifications that this type of partitioning must drown or swamp other ways of identifying people. That imperious view goes not only against the old-fashioned belief that we human beings are all much the same, but also against the more plausible understanding that we are diversely different. A narrowly reductionist categorization can have many far-reaching consequences through the neglect of other dimensions of human life. The world appears to be much more irreconcilably divided if there's only one way of partitioning people. We fall into some hardened classes with no permeation between them. In contrast, it can be argued that the robust source of unity in the world is not any imagined uniformity that exists across the globe, but the multiplicity of our diversities. We're definitely not the same, but we're different from each other in very many different ways. This is actually a theme that would have developed and all through the six lectures, and particularly to deal with it in the sixth lecture will be given in April. For example, what is often called the quote-unquote the Islamic world does, of course, have a preponderance of Muslims. But it also varies very greatly in political and social values, economic and commercial pursuits, and professional and philosophical involvements. The global lines of divisions are very differently drawn for these other affiliations. To focus just on the grand religious classification is not only to miss other significant concerns and ideas that move people, it also has the effect of lessening the importance of other priorities by artificially magnifying, through the weaponry of singular classification, the voice of religious authority. The mullahs and other religious authorities are then treated as the ex officio spokesmen for the so-called Islamic world, though a great many Muslims would have profound differences with what is proposed by one mullah or another. Reliance on the implicit presumption of some natural and overarchingly important categorization, which will overwhelm all other parts of our identity, is not only an epistemic mistake, it also serves as the foundation of a massive moral and political confusion. The proponents of clash of civilizations often reinforce their claim by looking at history and by extending the present divisions into the past. For example, Samuel Huntington argues, I quote, "The West was West long before it was modern." Huntington is referring here in particular, I quote again, to a sense of individualism and a tradition of individual rights and liberties, which he takes to be unique to Western civilization. Others have made similar or even stronger claims. And indeed, there are many supporters of the belief articulated by Gertrude Himmelfarb, like Huntington, also a great thinker and a great intellectual, that ideas of justice, right, reason, and love of humanity are predominantly, perhaps even uniquely, Western values, unquote. I have discussed elsewhere why this claim is very hard to sustain. Even though the championing of the so-called Asian values has often gone with rather little reading of Asian history, any serious study of Asian history brings out the presence of much plurality on issues of justice, right, reason, and love of humanity, or indeed tolerance. In fact, the historical roots of modern divisions are very hard to locate, especially given the pluralities within each culture. For example, India is often taken, rightly within a limited context, as a country with much religious fascination. And yet, it is also the case that Sanskrit has a substantially larger atheistic and agnostic literature than exists in any Western classical language, Greek or Latin or Hebrew. Or to look at the issue of tolerance, Emperor Ashoka could not have been less than pioneering in including strong principles of tolerance of different cultures and religions. He had himself moved from Hinduism to Buddhism, on the stone pillars displaying ethical and political postulate which he installed all over India in the 3rd century BC. The tenets included an unqualified demand for respecting the autonomy of persons because, as Ashoka put it, I quote, the sects of other people all deserve reverence for one reason or another, unquote. Western supremacists who claim that the Western civilization is uniquely tolerant, uniquely so, may join hands with Islamic fundamentalists who want to chastise the non-believer. But both would then be overlooking Islam's very long and distinguished history of tolerance. We would be left wondering what could have led Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher in the 12th century, to flee the persecution of Jews in Europe, to seek shelter, and to find an ordered life in Emperor Saladin's Egypt, the same Saladin who defended Islam in the Crusades. Similarly, the Mughal Emperor Akbar laid the foundations of secularism and religious neutrality of the Indian state, now reflected in India's post-independence constitution, through a variety of moves, for example, through the proclamation that it was the duty of the state to ensure, I quote, that no man should be interfered with on account of religion, and anyone is to be allowed to go over to a religion that pleases him, unquote. While Akbar was making these pronouncements on the occasion of the completion of the first millennium in the lunar Islamic Hijra calendar, the Inquisitions were going on with much vigor in Europe. Indeed, Giordino Bruno was burnt at the stake for heresy in Campo di Fiori in Rome in 1600, not long after Akbar's promulgation of the need for tolerance in Agra. Akbar's overarching thesis took the form of arguing that, I quote, the pursuit of reason rather than reliance on tradition has to be the basis of one's choice. In line with his pursuit of what he called the path of reason, Rahi Akal, Akbar insisted on the need for open dialogue and free choice, and also arranged recurrent meetings involving not only mainstream Hindu and Muslim philosophers, but also Christians, Jews, Parsis, Jains, and according to Abul Fazl, Akbar's intellectual ally, even the followers of Charvaka, one of the Indian schools of atheistic thinking, which by the time of Akbar was already 2,000 years old. Faced with such diversity among Muslim thinkers, it is tempting to ask, which is the correct view according to Islam? Is Islam a very tolerant religion, or is it not? Which is it really? The main issue to be faced here is not what the right answer to this question is, but whether the question itself is the right one to ask. Being Muslim is not an overarching identity that determines everything else. For example, Akbar's religious tolerance and heterodoxy had supporters as well as detractors among the influential Muslim groups in then India. And yet, when he died in 1605, the Islamic theologian Abdul Haq, who was very critical of many of Akbar's beliefs and actions, had to conclude that despite his innovations, Akbar had remained a good Muslim, unquote. It is possible for one Muslim to take an intolerant view and other to be very tolerant of heterodoxy without either of them ceasing to be a Muslim for that reason alone. This is not only because the idea of ijtihad or religious interpretation allows considerable latitude, but also because there are differences of views as to how much latitude ijtihad does allow. A remarkable diversity can be seen in the behavioral differences between two of Akbar's descendants. Emperor Aurangzeb is often cited in India today as being an intolerant Muslim king, intolerant particularly of Hindus, which in many ways he was. But his elder brother, Dara Shikoh, whom Akbar killed to grab the throne, was not only a serious scholar in the study of Hinduism, it is his Persian translation from Sanskrit done with the help of some Sanskrit pundits, because his knowledge of Sanskrit was rudimentary but keen. It is his translation from Sanskrit to Persian of the Hindu Upanishad, which was for many centuries one of the main foundations of European interest in Hindu religious philosophy. In fact, it's not often recognized that William Jones, who was the founder of the revival of Sanskrit studies, it was Darashikot's translation of the Persian translation Upanishad that he first encountered. That was his first encounter to Sanskrit thought, produced by the firstborn of the Mughal emperor. If being a Muslim were a Muslim's only identity, then of course the identification would have to carry the burden of resolving a great many choices a person faces. But this can hardly be the only identity that a Muslim has. Indeed, the denial of plurality, as well as the rejection of choice in matters of identity, can produce an astonishingly narrow and misdirected view. Even the current divisions around the events of September 11 have placed Muslims on all sides of the dividing lines. And rather than asking which is the right Islamic position, it has to be recognized that a Muslim can take one of several different positions on matters involving political, moral, and social judgment without ceasing to be, for that reason, a Muslim. There have been many discussions of the fact that a great many Muslims themselves died in the World Trade Center. And as persons working there, they did not evidently regard the World Trade Center to be an evil expression of Western civilization. However, the World Trade Center did, of course, have symbolic significance with its massive height and advanced technology, using the new tubular concept of structural engineering, which transformed the way tall buildings are constructed, and could be seen in bellicose eyes as an expression of Western audacity. And yet it is important to recall in this context that the principal engineer behind the tubular concept itself was Fazlur Rahman Khan, the Chicago-based engineer from Bangladesh, who did the basic work underlying the innovation. And later on also, I mean, he did not design the World Trade Center, though his work is acknowledged, and later on also designed several other tall buildings, including the Sears Tower and the John Hancock Center in Chicago, and also the Hajj Terminal in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Fazlur Rahman Khan also, to a different part of his identity, fought for Bangladesh's independence in 1971 and wrote a very readable Bengali book on that war, Muktijuddher Kahini. The fact that Muslims are on different sides of many cultural divides should not come at all as a surprise if being a Muslim is not taken to be an all-engulfing identity, which I think is what the foundational mistake here is. Time for me to conclude. I'm impressed by the extent to which contemporary cultural discourses are full of reports from as if war fronts, written by war correspondents in different shades of khaki, the clash of civilizations, the need to resist Western cultural imperialism, the commanding power of Asian values, the threat that Western civilization faces from the militancy of other cultures, and so on and so forth. The difficulty with the thesis of clashes arises, and clashes of civilization in particular, arises even before we get to the question whether there has to be a clash. The classification itself of the people of the world into distinct civilizations ignore not only the varieties within the civilization and their extensive interconnections, but also the fact that our cultural or religious affiliations are not our only identity, our only association. The focusing on religion and so-called civilization distracts attention not only from the plural diversities that characterize the people of the world, but it also encourages the analysts to overlook the diverse diversities that are critically important for understanding the contemporary world. The uniting theme of these lectures is the importance of the plurality of our identities and of the role of reasoning and of choice in making us what we are. We cannot hide away the questions we have to face and the choices we have to make by some arbitrary assumption of mutual incomprehensibility, allegedly due to the impenetrable barriers of culture. Nor can they be disposed of through some implausible conversion of the domain of reasoning into one of inert detection, the unreasoned politics of discovery. We have to take responsibility for the lives we lead, and even for the world in which we live. The alternative is not social wisdom, but intellectual surrender. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture by visiting professor and Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen of Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. Join us next week for an exploration of Genesis 1, the foundation of the Judeo-Christian tradition. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Walter Dixon, Tina Toby, and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Coming up at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. Then at 10:30, it's EuroQuest. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate networks worldwide for over 10 years, providing current information on virus threats such as the Nimda virus at sophos.com. By the Concord...